Welcome to In the News and Chris. I'm Jeff Watts, and today I'll be reading from the AARP magazine. First article is Finding a Place of Faith and Affordability. From suburban Orange County, California, to the small, deep south town of Muscle Shoals, Alabama. Quite the move. Jennifer Oliver, 58, and Lynch O'Connell, 63. Why relocate? California prices are insane, said Jennifer, a yoga teacher and freelance journalist. Lynn, a service engineer for tech business, was commuting 57 miles each way. Neither liked the stranglehold of consistently working only to feel like they were just scraping by, as Jennifer puts it. The O'Connells wanted a place that aligned with their Christian values. Muscle Shoals instantly hit our hearts, says Jennifer. She sent an email list to a pastor there whose sermon she appreciated. He got back to me within an hour. Then a campus coordinator connected me with a realtor who helped us find a home. I was like, wow, we're doing this. Last June, the O'Connells moved from California all the way to Alabama. Dollars and cents. Money goes much further in Muscle Shoals. We have a great three-bedroom, two-bath house that's roughly half the rent we're paying for much less space in California, says Lynn, who landed a service route with a regional communications and IT company. New above new horizons. Having built in a spiritual community provided a soft landing. An entire crew from church showed up at our house to move in and make us feel careful, Jennifer said. That was very nice. We're older Americans are on the move. Sunbelt states are attracting more than 50-plus residents from northern climates. States are that are people are moving. They're moving out of California, New York, Illinois, Jersey, Mass. Moving to Florida, Arizona, North, South Carolina, Texas. Here's another couple, Steve Rogers and Jane Rogers, both 60, from a Tony D.C. suburb to the hustle-bustle Big Apple to the quaint village of Hobart, New York. Why relocate? In 2009, after their Sam experienced a significant health crisis, the Rogers left the leafy D.C. Suburb of Leesburg, Virginia, their home for 20 years, to be near Sam in New York. With his health stabilized in 23, Jane and Steve headed way upstate to Hobart, New York, population 397, for ample space and a quieter, more affordable ease into retirement. Even with downsizing, moving from a single-family home into a two-bedroom Manhattan apartment wasn't cheap. Rent, groceries, restaurants, taxes, literally everything costs more in New York City, says Jane. She's a nonprofit exec who, like Steve, can work remotely. It helped to have an additional income from renting the Virginia place, but Steve, who designed security systems, wanted to reinvest the cash after selling that home in 2020. Property within a two-hour drive in New York City was out of reach, so we pushed it 3 hours, and yep, that did it, he says. The Rogers found a beautiful old four-bedroom house on an acre and a half with a converted barn guest house. This is part of our retirement plan, says Jane, whose goal is to work 2 more years. Steve intends to work to age 65. We'll use the guest house as an Airbnb beginning next year, and hopefully that income will keep us going, Jane says. And we have enough space to host Sam and his friends anytime he wants to come up to visit. Here's another one. Doreen Hell, 51, and Marquise Vaughn, 46. Priced out of paradise, Sin City beckon. From tropical Pearl City in central Hawaii to the go-go greater Las Vegas area. Why relocate? A native Hawaiian, Doreen assumed she would live out her days in Hawaii. But after her daughter moved to the mainland for a nursing job, Doreen decided in 2019 to follow with her husband and their son, who is now 10, In a more affordable setting, we could work to live rather than living to work, she says. Hawaii, it's got the highest cost of living in the U.S. Doreen couldn't believe the savings. The four-bedroom, three-bath house she and her husband, an Air Force reservist and truck driver, bought for $300,000 would have cost us at least twice as much back in Hawaii. Doreen feared that homesickness would overwhelm her, but Las Vegas has Hawaiian barbecue restaurants, hula chefs, famous Hawaiian entertainers. It's easy to live the aloha here, she says. Here's another one. Rich Morrison and Terry, 73 and 67. From a 7-acre Idaho farm with horses to a downsized home in Boise. Why relocate? Magical as it was, farm life was just too costly and challenging to maintain as the Morrisons grew older. So we made the hardest choice we ever faced, says Terry, a travel writer. During the wintertime, especially, we were hiring people to come in and clean us horse poop and do other things we no longer could do. The Morrisons sold the farm and moved to Idaho's capital city in January 2022. Dollars and cents. When you factor in the cost of keeping animals and how much we pay to irrigate and power our gas, we're saving a significant amount, says Rich, a retired educator. The Morrisons rehomed their three horses. That leaves extra for urban niceties like dinners out, all kinds of great restaurants nearby, and pursuing passions like skiing. We hit the neighborhood lottery, Terry says, with warm and welcoming residents on all four sides. Well, some questions you may want to ask yourself if you do decide to move. Six questions to ask. Why do you want to move? What are you trying to accomplish? Are you looking to be closer to your family? Or maybe you crave out more sunshine. Be clear about your priorities. What do you love about your current home that you can't live without? Make sure your new location satisfies your most must-have requirements. What kind of lifestyle are you seeking? Consider the activities you enjoy now and whether you can reasonably pursue them in your new home. What about your healthcare needs? And can those needs be met in your new home? Consider the quality, cost, and proximity to medical services, especially if you have a condition that requires routine checkups and cares. Can you afford the cost of living in a new place? Take a hard look at your finances. Selling your home, saving the equity, and moving to a more affordable area with lower housing costs can be a great way to stretch your retirement savings. Will it be less costly to live in the new place over the long term? A lower cost of living doesn't necessarily guarantee a lower cost in the future. You have to consider whether it's going to be sustainable and affordable over the long term in that location. Do careful research on the place you're considering moving to and try to anticipate factors that may inflate your cost of living. Here's a couple more examples of people who moved. From Burlington, Kansas to Cosmopolitan, Kansas City, Kansas. Why did they relocate? Why did she, Nancy Hess, who was 70? Don't laugh, says Hess, who has lived in small Kansas towns all her life. But my gut was telling me that if I stayed in Burlington, I would turn into one of those little old ladies who never leaves the house. She admits she felt she'd been coasting ever since Sam, her partner of 22 years, passed away 13 years ago. So after retiring as a computer program analyst at a nuclear plant in 2020, I felt like stepping out of my comfort zone and pushing myself. City life, it's more expensive, she says. Hess senior living community in Kansas City required entrance and service fees, and KC prices are higher for things like dinners and entertainment. But that's why I worked a desk job for 34 years, she said. With plenty of activities at her complex, there's a fitness center, for example, the convenience of balance and the cost. It feels like a fresh start to me, says Hess, who loves being 30 minutes of countless activities and events, having people from her community to do things, which is icing on the cake. She attends Kansas City Monarchs baseball games, summertime jazz band, and dinner theater events, as well as visiting local historical societies, libraries, quilt shops. At first, I was a little bit hesitant going around town, but now I'm happy even if I'm getting lost and finding my way back home. Rabbi Joe Hample, 68, and Barry Wendell, 75. Greater meeting at a much slower pace. From busy LA to somewhat sleepy Morgantown, West Virginia. Why did they relocate? Joe and Barry met and married at a gay synagogue in LA, where Joe was studying to be a rabbi after a career as a system analyst, and Barry worked as a soloist and a teacher. They wanted out. I lived in LA for 25 years already. It's like, I'm ready for something new, says Barry. After Joe landed a rabbi gig deep in Appalachia, the move was on. Morgantown is dirt cheap by California standards, says Joe. We could never afford it in a house in LA or any hot California community real estate area. New and above horizons for a pair of confirmed urbanites. Moving to a quieter locale meant finding God in the details, figuring out your favorite flavors of ice cream, taking long walks, spending time with a nice lady next door who feeds our cat. The little things that take on greater meaning here, Joe says. But the pace carved out more time as well. Barry found a late-in-life calling as a public servant. He spent two times on Morgan City Council and even ran for U.S. Congress in 2022. Wow. Seeking culture and active lifestyle on a smaller scale. Dave and Jill, both 65. They went from Charlotte, North Carolina to the tiny town of Abingdon, Virginia. The Daltons love Charlotte, metro area around 3 million. But when Dave retired as a manufacturing exec in 2021, he craved a more active outdoor lifestyle. He and Jill both wanted a walkable small town with vibrant culture, an art scene, great food, and more youthful population. They went all in on Abingdon, with a historic Main Street, access to trout fishing and biking, more than 30 restaurants, and the nation's longest-running professional theater. And when the town's median age of 45, retirees are able to mix with younger residents. Can you say Dreamtown, says Jill? The dollars and cents of this. The Daltons bought a three-floor historic house from 1803 and are making the renovation a retirement project, adding HVAC and bumping up those low Jefferson area ceilings isn't cheap, but costs in general are a fraction of what they are in Charlotte, Dave says. Life is more relaxed, and there's a warmth from people you don't always get in an urban setting, Jill says. Once you meet someone here, you look out for each other. According to Dave, there aren't enough days in the week for all the activities Abingdon offers. He already serves on Abington's board and tourism advisory council, and there's hiking, kayaking, horseback riding, an annual fiddler's convention, pickleball, and tons of golf. I thought people were supposed to slow down in retirement, he says, but it's not looking that way. The bravest of the brave. The Vietnam War was a nearly painful end 50 years ago, but the war that divided a generation also provided stories of sacrifice, courage, and of the roughly 2.7 million Americans who served there. Veterans are fighting in the Southeast Asia are in their 70s or older now. They endured disdain after returning from war, and many have wrestled with physical and psychological problems since then, from Agent Orange to post-traumatic stress disorder. As Veteran Day's tribute to those who served in Vietnam, we talked to some of the bravest of the brave, the 268 men who received the Congressional Medal of Honor. We also examined what life has been after that. With their deeds are exceptional, their lives reflect much of what happened to the men and women who answered the call. I had to get my brother, Sammy Lee Davis, 77, from Indiana. I was born in Dayton, in Ohio. My dad was in the military. I joined the Army in 1966, and I remember stepping off the airplane in Vietnam. It was nice and cool in the plane, and it was 100 degrees outside. Stepping off the airplane, we soldiers looked at each other in amazement. On the night of November 18th, 1967, I was with Battery C, 2nd Battalion, 4th Artillery, 9th Infantry Division, patrolling a fire base. We were told we were going to get hit that night, and the battle started at 2 a.m. There was a river, and we saw the enemy coming toward us on the other side, shooting at us. The Viet Cong fired a RPG, rocket-propelled grenade, to hit our cannon, and the explosion threw me, unconscious, back into the foxhole. They thought I was dead. My ears were ringing, and I couldn't hear. When I came to, I could see the enemy running toward me, and I did my job as a soldier. I picked up my M16 and started firing. That's when one of our guys, Wendell Holloway of California, waved his hat at me from the other side of the river, shouting, "Don't shoot, I'm a GI," he screamed. "Come get me." My back, it was broken, my ribs were crushed, and I'd been shot in the right leg with an AK-47. But I had to get my brother, because he would have done the same for me. I swam across the river, and when I got there, there were three men, not just Wendell, all wounded, one unconscious. I used an air mattress to help get us all back on the other side. I dragged everyone back across the river, and when I got there, my guys helped me get everyone out. We all survived. When I woke up in the hospital in Japan, I'd been unconscious for a few days. General William Westmoreland was standing beside my bed. He had some 30 beehives, piece of shrapnel in his hand that a surgeon had removed from my body. He said, "Son, we're going to retire you from the Army and send you home." But I didn't want to go home. General Westmoreland understood. I needed closure. I needed it for my soul to be okay. So I went back to Vietnam. I set foot back in American soil on March 13, 1968. You have probably seen footage of the ceremony when I received the Medal of Honor. In the movie Forrest Gump, when Forrest is receiving his medal, that is my actual film footage. They put Tom Hanks' face over mine. Every time I see Forrest Gump, it brings back memories. I have often been told people that if I haven't received the Medal of Honor, I probably would have become a cow thief or something. In other words, I probably would have been doing bad things. But because of the Medal of Honor and the respect that I have for it, I didn't want to do anything that would cause disrespect. It kept me doing right. In fact, when I learned that I was going to receive the medal, I thought right then, I'm going to have to be good. And I started trying to do better and better at everything. It worked. After 3 years in the Army, I was medically retired. I couldn't do anything without hurting real badly, but I knew I had to get a job. I went to work for Champion Laboratories in West Salem, Illinois, a company owned by Andy Granati, who was a great man. I don't believe he was a veteran, but he acted like he was. Readers may have heard of him. He was a legendary race car driver, CEO of STP, and a major sports of Indianapolis 500 cars. At the same time, the Medal of Honor had become a way of life. It's a brotherhood. We all know what each other went through, and we encourage each other to stand up to be proud. The Medal of Honor has taught me how to express love for America and love for my fellow man. When I wear the medal, when I'm going to speak engagements, I try not to preach politics, but I want every American to stand up for what they believe in. I always open up to questions and answers, and I found that I enjoy most of all, especially when I'm speaking to schools. There are some great questions you get from 10-year-old kids. When people ask me how the Medal of Honor changed my life, the first thing I say is it kept me doing right my whole life. It made me stand taller and walk prouder. Whenever I talk with people, I tell them the same thing. No matter what you face with, you don't lose until you quit trying. African-American Green Beret finally receives the highest honor. Paris Davis, he's 85, from Virginia. The Special Forces was fairly new at the time. It was a small group. formed to be the eyes and ears of American battle and helping us keep it safe. When I started my training, I had already gone through Army Ranger and Airborne School. Earning my way into Special Forces was no bowl of cherries. We did a lot of classroom work, we jumped out of airplanes, and we did all kinds of things with weapons. A lot of people did not like the idea of me joining the Special Forces, and they were hoping I wouldn't make it. But I wouldn't back down. The more I did to prove that I could make it as a Ranger, I became friends. I made it easier to become. In the spring of 65, I was 26 years old and stationed in South Vietnam. We found out there were a couple places where the Viet Cong were sending troops to about 25 kilometers from where we were located. We were going to have a slowdown. The big battle at Bong Song was the result. It lasted over 2 days, mainly June 17th and 18th, 1965. I was the 5th Special Forces Group Airborne, 1st Special Forces, and commander of a small operation team called A321. There were 4 Americans in that operation, myself and 3 others. We were training a force of local volunteers from Vietnam. The battle was on. According to my official citation, Captain Davis's advice and leadership allowed the company to gain the tactical advantage, allowing it to surprise the unsuspecting enemy force and kill approximately 100 enemy soldiers. Following an ambush, I had a situation where I went out there and 3 of my fellow Special Forces soldiers who got spread out and bring them back to safety. Also, from the official Medal of Honor citation, Captain Davis consistently exposed himself to hostile small arms fire to rally the inexperienced and disorganized company. He expertly directed both artillery and small arms fire. Although wounded in the leg, he aided in the evacuation of other wounded men of his unit, but he refused medical evacuation himself. Then, with complete disregard for his life, he braved intense enemy fire to cross an open field to rescue his seriously wounded sergeant. We fought hard for 2 days before we could put this behind us. I was shot up pretty bad, and I was in the hospital for a long time. I never asked any questions. I just let them take care of me. Meanwhile, my fellow soldiers and others were concerned about what had happened at Bong Son, and they took it upon themselves to come together. While I was in the hospital, I didn't know anything from Shiola. You know how the saying goes. But people on my team made a big to-do about it, and I was nominated to receive the Medal of Honor. What happened next will surprise you. It certainly surprised me. I don't want it to sound like I was bragging, so please don't take my words that way. I was rewarded 2 Purple Hearts, a Silver Star, and any number of other medals, but the government lost my Medal of Honor paperwork not once, but twice. How did that happen? That's a question I've been asked many times. I don't know. Don't ask me. Ask the government. When you find out, we'll both know. But there's a lot of hullabaloo, and people on my team went to Congress. They wrote letters and did whatever they could to let the people know what's going on here. When I received the Medal of Honor in the White House, that was on March 3rd, 2023, not too long ago, it changed my life in many ways. But number one is it changed the perception of people that I knew. Because so many people I knew did not understand what had happened at Bong Son. That's B-O-N-G, then S-O-N. When they had a chance to read and hear the whole narrative as it started in my Medal of Honor citation, then they could understand not just my story, but the story of the people that were there with me. They knew that we had done something that was extraordinary. Second, I invited people to be there that day, people who had trained with me, and families of soldiers. That day in the White House, the I became we and the we became us, and it continues. I will tell you from my point of view, at this time in my life, we have some great guys and gals in the military. I think America should pay homage to people on a military who are willing to go out there and stick their thumb in the air to see which way the wind is blowing to make sure that America remains free. Final one is a Marine's hell commences a storied career. Harvey Barnum, 84. December 65, I was attached to the 2nd Battalion. We hit the deck. The enemy aimed. This was the first time I'd been shot at. I looked up, and all those young Marines were looking at me. I'd only been with this company for about 4 days. What do I know? These young Marines were scared. Anyone who says they're not scared when they're getting shot at is, they're lying. We realized that we not only were ambushed, we were nearly surrounded. I ran out, picked up our captain, and brought him back to a more secure area. He died in my arms. I realized the radio was out there and I was going to need it. So I ran out and took the radio off the dead radio operator. I strapped it on and contacted a battalion. Ultimately, the battle commander told me, "You have to come out of there. We can't get you." The battalion was fully engaged. We were in one heck of a fight. There's no future in doing this. If we stayed in the darkness, the enemy was going to finish us off. We put the dead and wounded on the helicopters. We had a medic named Doc West, and he was wounded, but he refused a shot of morphine. He was the last one on the helicopter. As we put him up there, he was shot for the 7th time. Years later, I found out that he, incredibly, had survived. Those of us on the ground got organized. I called in an airstrike against enemy positions. Ultimately, I told a group of Marines, when you start going, you run as fast as you can and don't stop unless someone gets shot. If someone gets shot, you pick them up and keep going because Marines don't leave anyone behind on the battlefield. I received the Medal of Honor back in 67. I was told the White House did not want to present the medal. I believe it was because Johnson was getting so much bad press. I was decorated by the Secretary of Navy. I was the first Medal of Honor recipient to go back to Vietnam. I was a professional Marine, and there was a war going on. I would be naive to think that the Medal of Honor didn't help my career. I served the military for 30 years and always tried to use the medical as a platform to continue serving. I traveled the country speaking to students, American Legions. I took every opportunity to let people know how fortunate they are to live in this great country. Before I retired, I have the privilege of serving my country as a Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Navy. I have had a Navy ship named after me, a destroyer. I have met sports stars, movie stars, kings, and queens. None of that would happen without the Medal of Honor. But the most important thing has been the opportunity to keep serving my country. When I retired from the military, I continued talking to audiences. To me, it's a chance to remind people, if they are need reminding, that we live in the greatest country on earth. Well, that's all the time we have for today. Jeff Watson, I've been reading from the AARP magazine. So long until next time.